This is the North Georgia Life Podcast. Embrace life where you live. Welcome to the North Georgia Life Podcast. Jake, your host here. Today's episode, it is one of the longer episodes, maybe the longest episode I've done so far, but it is one of the most fascinating. And I say that, and we've got a lot of fascinating things already, but this one is kind of a super unique in that Mark is involved in the local history of North Georgia. He's an educator. He's got an environmental. He's a sportsman. He's got all these different legs of life that he's involved with and has been involved with and has done exceptionally well at. And we talk about some of those things in the podcast. But he's also going to be at some local events here coming up in the next month or two. So if you want to meet him, you want to go look at his materials, his books. He's written a number of books that kind of cover a variety of different things. Just such, fascinating is the only word that I think is appropriate. Just amazing story of how we got here. I think you're genuinely going to enjoy the story of how the Medicine Bow and Mark Warren came to be what they are today. You know how to find us online, Facebook, Instagram, North Georgia Life Podcast, northgeorgialifepodcast@gmail.com if you want to email us. And if there's any suggestions, things you'd like to see coming up in future episodes, just send them our way and we'll kind of filter through them. And you know, a lot of it, honestly, is logistical matching up. I've got people that I've been chasing down for almost a year now that are some of my favorite places in our North Georgia region. And we just hadn't been able to get schedules to align. So we'll do our best. I do have a full-time job, as you know, but I think this is just a growing resource in our area that is all about helping you embrace life right where you live. And this is a really, really unique way of doing that. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to the North Georgia Life Podcast. Jake, your host. And today we have an episode that is, I think, going to blow your socks off because as a young person growing up, one of my favorite things in the world was watching the episodes of MacGyver when they came out. And I feel like we have a version of a real-life MacGyver in our North Georgia region today. His name is Mark Warren, and he is the owner of an organization called Medicine Bow, which is rooted here in North Georgia and is a lot of different things, but has a focus on education, programming, and really giving people a different lens of insight into our native land here in North Georgia, which was occupied by the Cherokee long before we got here. And he is a wealth of knowledge in a lot of different arenas. We'll kind of get into how you got here. You've got a really unique operation. I think a pretty neat story in getting here. And so, Mark, I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So we were just talking about before, so you are from Georgia, but not from the North Georgia mountains.
Right. I've been here for about 45 years, but I started out in a small town, what was a small town at that time, below Atlanta. And I was just born with a love for the forest that was unexplainable. So that's where my whole journey began. I spent all the time that I could in forest. And when I discovered the mountains at age 13 and started hitchhiking up here to camp and to explore, that became the place I was going to spend the rest of my life.
So you, as a young teenager, you hitchhiked just to get up in the woods.
Yes, and I would like to thank my mother right here for allowing me to do that.
Oh, times have changed.
Oh, yeah.
Prior to starting Medicine Bow, share with us a little bit about your story. I did a little bit of digging online. You probably wouldn't talk about this otherwise, but you have some like pretty significant accomplishments that are not related to what you're doing now in terms of your canoeing, archery. How did you get into, what was the transition like from being somebody who in the late 90s was winning the U.S. National Championship in canoe slalom and then the World Championship in longbow the year after that, and now you're the Medicine Bow guy in North Georgia?
Well, I was doing that same kind of work at that time. And those two areas, canoeing and archery, are really not removed from what I do. I teach classes in both. And, of course, they both have their roots in Native American culture. Mm-hmm. Here, and that's more or less my specialty, is teaching how the forest was used by the Cherokee. So if I am a MacGyver, I'm a very, I guess, a buckskin clad one, because I actually don't know many things about electronics, and like MacGyver did, as I remember that show. It's an interesting story how I got involved in both of those areas. I had never shot a bow before. I was 20 years old, and I was in an area of wilderness that I loved, up at War Woman Creek, mm-hmm. in Rabun County. I used to go there a lot and just spend days exploring. And I stepped out into an open lane between huge white pines that just kind of made a colonnade of open space between these trees, and it was odd. I'd not been thinking about archery. I hadn't been exposed to anything about it lately. And my mouth opened, and I said, I should be shooting a bow. And it had to do with that long straight distance that you could see through those pines. Mm-hmm. And I went home that night, and the next day I became an archer.
Really?
Yeah. Same thing happened with canoeing. I used to love to simply follow rivers, mm-hmm. When I was hiking. I've really not done much trail hiking at all. Mine has all been off the trail, but I found rivers to be the alluring path. And then one evening, after I'd set up my camp, and I just walked down to the river's edge, and I looked out on this beautiful pool. I was on the Chattooga River. Mm-hmm. And I said out loud, again, this voice, I didn't know it was coming. It said, I should be canoeing.
Really?
And the next week, I owned a canoe.
Wow. That's and what were you, did you go to college? I mean, what was your education like? Because your level of education and what you do and what you teach is clearly at the highest level. So I didn't get into that far as your background education and just kind of building your own intellect and resources internally.
Well, I started off at a military school. My parents had me and my brother attend there, and I was bewildered why I was being sent there. And I found out when I was in my 40s, my mom finally divulged that little secret to me, that it was my brother who needed that. And they didn't feel like they could send him without sending me. But it was great, because they really did have excellent teachers there. And that's where I fell in love with learning. Mm. And from there, I went to the University of Georgia, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I decided to start off with what I knew I loved, and that was artwork. And so I started out studying art. I wanted to be a commercial artist, I thought. And in the art sessions there, with using human models, I just became fascinated with the human body. So I switched over to the sciences and ended up graduating with a degree in chemistry, pre-med, and was heading toward medical school the next year. And that summer, before I went, I decided I could not just enter medical school and go through all that, become a physician, and have all those long hours and lose all of my outside time. Mm-hmm. I knew I had to be more connected to the outdoors. So that was the big change there.
Gotcha. And so you've been in this arena ever since yeah. making that change?
Yeah. I was a good student in college. I studied very hard. I was the exception to the rule, I believe, at the University of Georgia, and that it, most of the people that I knew there had different agenda than I did. But I loved to learn. And when I got out of school, my autodidactic part of my life has actually been much more intense than my schooling, in that I've put more time and energy and passion into learning about all these things that I teach. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I've come by it honestly.
Yeah, yeah. Transitioning into that, can you give us a short history of Medicine Bow, your operation, all of the, and I don't know how if you can actually do it shortly, but all of the different things that you do and you teach, and where that was kind of birthed out of from your own life into what it is now?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, as I said, my love for the forest was sharp, and I just saw the forest as the greatest available adventure that we could have. And I don't mean necessarily exciting whitewater, which is wonderful, or rock climbing, which is wonderful, but it was just being out there and knowing how to do the things that were everyday things to paleo people, which are now very esoteric. I mean, mm-hmm. few people know how to, for example, create fire with their hands, you know, mm-hmm. without a match, without flint and steel. And that all that fascinated me. So all along, I had this drive to learn those things. I knew that I was walking through these forests in the footsteps of the Cherokee, and I wanted to know more about how they lived. And that, I guess, you know, really what it was a search for more intimacy with the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the Cherokee had that. You always have that when you live on a daily basis that close to nature. Which is one of the great divisions that we have now, the separation that most people have from nature, which mm-hmm. which breaks my heart, because that means that nature won't get the attention that it needs to be preserved.
Right.
But anyway, so I first thing I did was to, I knew I wanted to work somehow for the environment, so I volunteered at the Georgia Conservancy in Atlanta. And it was an office job, and it was one that dealt with issues around the state that were environmental. And I did not like that work. I knew I wasn't good at it, and I had to just kind of slog through that. And then one day at that job, the director came out and said, there's a school that's on the phone. They want somebody to come out and speak to children about so-and-so. I don't even remember what it was now. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been swamps. So I raised my hand at that, and that became my job description there. All I did was provide programs for the conservancy, and they were about just about every subject you can imagine. And I had a great library there, a great resource of mentors on their board, because, you know, we had people there like Eugene Odom, who was considered the father of ecology at the University of Georgia, and lots of people like that that I could learn from. And so I started working in summers when, you know, schools were not going in summers, so I had a chance to do a different job and then come back and work for the conservancy. And that summer job was to work at a summer camp. And there I began a new program of taking kids away from the camp in Roswell, Georgia, up to the mountains. And we just went out into the national forest. We didn't have a real place that we used. We just set up a primitive camp and spent a week there, and it became known as Outpost Camp. And that was really the seed of my doing what I'm doing now. And as soon as I started doing that for the camp, Camp High Meadows, which was just a wonderful learning ground for me, I knew that I was going to end up doing that on my own in a little different venue and get more serious about the skills for those who wanted to learn them. So I came up here and without a place to live and just lived in the forest for a while and camped here and there and stayed at a friend's or whatever for a while. And finally found a place to lease up here that had beautiful land on it on the Etowah River. And there I started Medicine Bow officially and doing classes. And all that time I was looking for my own land because I knew I needed that to continue what I was doing, and finally found it. So here I am.
Hmm. I think it's important, especially for students that are in the, you know, high school, college, early adulthood phase. I had been at, I do some volunteer work with the University of North Georgia. And last year, I was talking with a class, and one of the students asked me a question, and he said, what do you think
most students coming out of school now are lacking, which I thought was a very astute and just very deep question for somebody to just ask in a business class. And I, honestly, I didn't have to think about it very hard because I said ambition. And I said, I feel like this generation, I say generation meaning maybe under 30 or so, by and large, you know, that's the first generation that there has not been some sort of major world event. Now, COVID is a different thing, but it wasn't World War II. It wasn't the Cold War. There wasn't those things where people were practicing nuclear drills in their thing. And I said, what I feel like that had done inadvertently is give people a driving sense of purpose. There wasn't so much wandering time, and now, you know, our phones and electronics and Netflix and all those things kind of invade or infiltrate that space of what am I supposed to be doing? And I think it's important to point out in your story that because so much of our society is an instant society, you were doing a job that you really didn't like in an office that you really didn't want to be in, but that was how you got, that was the bridge to get you to where your life passion was found. And I think it's important to highlight that it's not every moment that is the great thing that you're doing, but it's sometime you do have to wade through the swamp, so to speak, to get to the place you really want to be. And knowing that everything's not an overnight, you know, an overnight thing, and sometimes the first thing is not the best thing or really where you want to be, but it's how you get to that place.
Right. You know, and that reminds me of something I think about a lot, and that is that when I went to college, I knew only one person whom I had met who knew what he wanted to be.
Mm.
And that person, interestingly, was going to be an astronaut.
Wow.
And I ran into him years later after college, and he was working as a landscaper.
Wow.
The complete opposite of leaving the Earth.
Wow.
But the point is that I'm a strong believer in spreading out with electives in college, because you may bump into your passion,
yeah,
which you never could have met otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. I wish I had done that more when I was in school, and I didn't. But your organization, Medicine Bow, where'd the name come from?
Well, I think probably it began with my love for archery. And within the history of archery, there is actually a medicine bow from Native American cultures. And that bow was ceremonial. It never was used for warfare or for hunting. So it's a bow that never killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I used to be a hunter. I was an avid hunter. I don't hunt anymore, and that's my choice. And I'm not an anti-hunter by any means. But because I choose not to hunt anymore, that symbol of the medicine bow is a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm.
I have actually another adventure that has taken the place of hunting, and that is simply stalking animals without anything in my hands. And to me, there's hardly an adventure that I would think could surpass that one, because I just simply love to watch an animal in its day, going mm-hmm. through its day and learning about it that way. And whoever loses that that little secret hiding sensation, you know, mm-hmm. we all love to hide and watch things. And to me, that's the ultimate.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite moments of sneaking up on XYZ animal?
Sure. Well, there have been so many. They're actually the memories that are in the front of my mind more than any other. I feel like I've often thought that, you know, if I knew that I were passing away, it would probably be those little reels of film that would run mm-hmm. through my head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that take on your life flashing before your eyes, it would be the animal lives. But a couple of them I've written about, and I wrote a memoir back in, I think, 2012. And it was about the 2 years that I lived in a teepee here on this property before I built a house. And that's a wonderful life in a teepee because it puts you in the way of nature. And so you're going to see things, you know, on a daily basis. And during that time, I had one great experience. I saw movement through some mountain laurel in a grove. And so I dropped into my stalking phase and began moving toward it. And then when I was about 15 yards away, I could see that it was a deer. And as I got within about, I'd say 12 yards, a doe ran off. But then there was still movement there. So I came on a little closer, very, very slowly, and there was a newborn fawn.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know why I did this, but I went down on all fours and just approached that little baby.
Wow.
And I tried to make sounds like it was making, which was a bleating sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it came over, and it punched its muzzle right up into the sleeve of my T-shirt.
Wow.
And sniffed my armpit. And we just stayed like that for a while. It was looking for something to get milk from.
Yeah.
So that was a great one.
Wow. Your comment, though, about putting yourself in a place where you're in the way of nature. I don't do as much hunting as I used to, but I still remember one day, this was probably 3-4 years ago now, that I was in a tree stand, and the same day, and I wasn't out very long, maybe 2 hours, I saw a red fox just come right underneath my stand, just going wherever it was going. And then within about 20 minutes, there was this, I don't even know what kind of owl it was, but, you know, your barn owl came flying down probably about 10 feet below me and perched up on a branch 15, 20 feet from me, just staring at me. Mm. And it was one of those things, you know, I've seen a lot of birds fly. You talk about just graceful and silent. I mean, silent as silent can be. Mm. You know, that it was just one of the more remarkable things that I've, you know, days, mornings, moments that I've had in the woods. And there are things like that that you will never be able to experience indoors, or even watching, you know, in a documentary or something. Being out in nature, in you know, your natural surroundings, it's completely different. There's something about it.
Yeah, well, just think, it used to be the only way
right. To
be, and we're still connected to that. There's a word, atavism, that connects us to things that our ancestors experienced. It's something that really lives in our genes, and I think it's why when a school bus comes here for a program and the kids come off the bus into my parking lot, which is graveled, and they immediately start hurling rocks at trees, you know, that's just the hunter instinct, and that's atavistic. But we've got a lot of that in us that we'll never really understand, and it just surfaces in us.
You have different programs for different levels, different interests. You have programs that are for plant identification and usages and things like that. You have things that are maybe more historically based with artifacts and different things from, you know, the history, local history here. Share with us a little bit about what those things look like, if somebody is interested in, you know, making a field trip or bringing you to wherever they're at, you know, whether it be their own organization or a business environment or a classroom setting or whatever. What are some of those things? What do they look like?
I have classes here for the public that are small classes. I never take more than a dozen people. And some are smaller classes than that because I don't want to lose the intimacy of a classroom, an outdoor classroom. And those are now only day classes. I don't do overnight classes anymore as I'm getting older. But those might range from how to create fire to the skill of stalking, the skill of tracking, how to read tracks and identify animals and to discern what they're doing by their tracks. I teach archery classes and all the survival skills, one subject at a time. So those are for the serious student who really wants to know how to perform those things and put some physical time in here in learning those things. By far, my most popular classes are those that are about plant identification, because people want to know how to be a little more self-reliant and eat some wild foods and use medicines that are around them. I also take classes away from here. I think one of my most popular is called Through the Eyes of the Cherokee, where I simply take a small group out into forest and we start looking at the woods through the Cherokee's eyes to see what right there before us is useful and how. And I'm a strong believer in teaching those things that have been backed up by either my experience or by scientific verification, especially with medicines. And, of course, the identification process of plants is a really important part of all this, because you don't want to make a mistake about a species. That's how people get themselves into jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to school classes. I do indoor programs. Sometimes it might be to a school in an auditorium. But usually, with my urging, it's a smaller setting. It's the classroom itself. And those classes can vary from very specific survival skills to overarching concepts like ecology or conservation or water, you know, rivers and lakes and groundwater and what all that means to us, and just a variety of subjects. And private individuals come here with small groups for classes. We set that up and run it exactly as they would like to have the agenda go. So those are real pleasing too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky in my classes here. I'm always drawing people here who already have the interest, you know. So I get people who have some of the passion. When I go to schools, of course, that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
So my job there is to try to win them over. And like you had alluded to, we have quite a challenge in our lab nowadays in that way, because we have so much competition from the beautiful screens that people carry around. And, I mean, those things are really alluring, and I guess you could say addictive. And and we have to compete with that. And when you're inside of a classroom doing that, it's tricky. So that's why I have a lot of things that I take with me. Now, these are not actually artifacts of the Cherokee, but these are crafts that I've made in the way of the Cherokee. So not in a workshop somewhere with tools, but, you know, they look crude and primitive, but very useful and utilitarian. And this is what kids just love. They love to see these old things. They just love to see what a piece of rawhide looks like before you tan it, and then the magic of making it into buckskin, and then the magic of seeing the moccasins and the archery equipment and even baskets. You know, you would think, what school class would be interested in seeing a basket? But when you learn how to make one from a simple slab of bark that you can take off of a tulip tree in the springtime, and you can score that bark two curved lines to make it bend, and you've got a really clever design of a basket. But kids love these things, and I usually take with me some supplies of inner bark from the tulip tree, which is the most prolific source of fibers that we have here in this part of the world, and teach the kids how to make rope. Rope is the great unsung hero of human inventions. You know, we were known as the inventors for so long before we found out that other animals share that label. But we definitely were inventors, and rope was what was a huge transition, because it allowed us to attach one thing to another, like a point to a shaft on a spear. So rope is all important. We take it for granted now because we wear rope. You know, our clothing is made of threads, and we don't have any connection to that anymore. We don't know who made it, what the pattern was, or anything. So to start from scratch like that, sometimes a child making a piece of rope from shreds of bark will be maybe the one and only time in that child's life that he or she makes something out of raw natural materials, mm-hmm. and it becomes an effective tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In your classes, are they a couple hours? Are they all day? What's the norm?
They're all day. They run from about 9 o'clock until 4.
Okay.
And when I do private classes, they're either a half day or a whole day.
Okay. Awesome. For somebody who's maybe they have a passion that is in the what I would say maybe the unconventional path of business, like I think you would probably say this is unconventional. This is not an accounting firm or something like that. Any nuggets of wisdom from your years of experience and the roads that you've traveled to get to where you're at now that you would share with somebody who was maybe either in the brainstorming entry-level phase, or maybe just kind of somewhere in that first part of the journey?
I feel like it all orbits around that concept of passion. Mm. You've just got to find out what your passion is. And the sad thing is, I think this probably attaches to that idea you were talking about lack of ambition. I think there are a lot of more people today who don't possess a passion and don't know how to go about getting one. And I think it's because of that clutter that you mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, probably. We've got so many things thrown at us. Just think about a life on YouTube. A person could spend a life watching YouTube, yeah. I'm sure, and feel like they're experiencing life. I guess my advice would be, if you don't already possess a passion, well, let me start here. If you do possess a passion, pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. And that could branch out into a dozen different areas that a person might take for a vocation. But if you're involved with your passion, your life is going to be so much happier. Yeah. I talk to so many people who are unhappy because of their jobs. They're doing time, you know, and they're,
yeah.
And I don't think you create a loyalty to your work when you're doing time.
That's right.
And so you're not going to be the best employee at that mm-hmm. too. Find that thing that you really care about. And if you don't have a passion, figure out some way to get more involved in life mm-hmm. rather than vicarious life. And I think you'll run into it. You'll have to find something that will interest you.
Yep. Yep. I was actually talking to somebody this week that they're in that younger generation, early 20s, and they had a close friend that their whole growing up, their dad just emphasized, you know, get a job that's going to make you a lot of money. And they've got a good job. They're, you know, in their early 20s, so it's an entry-level job at that point, but they're making good money, and they're miserable. Mm-hmm.
And that advice came from a person who had struggled, no doubt,
yeah.
and knew the value of getting a good job. But, you know, life became a different experience after World War II, I believe. And so many people had so much. Mm. I don't mean that they were just cluttered in possessions, but there was a certain kind of happiness there with that generation that came up who had struggled through yep. the Depression. And they got to this level of comfort. And the great irony of the story is that I'm a baby boomer, and you know, those of us who are, we grew up with a lot of things easy. And I believe that a lot of parents actually resented their children for it in a subliminal way. And I took a choice of, I don't think my father ever recognized this in me, but I chose a path that was a struggle. Mm-hmm. I could have gone to medical school,
right.
And I know I would have gotten through that and done well, and I'd be somewhere in an office today helping people as a physician, but it just wasn't for me. And stepping off of that path was a much bigger challenge for mm-hmm. me, and trying to create my job as I did. Tricky thing.
Yeah. Any favorite memories, best stories, just experiences maybe in a classroom environment, students being old, young, anywhere in the middle that has just been particularly memorable, rewarding, just kind of made you feel great about the having gone through the struggle and come to where you're at now?
Well, I would say that the best feeling is after a class when someone comes up to me and says that somehow a window got opened for them and they saw something in a way they hadn't seen it before. And so a life was changed in some, to some degree, and I feel so gratified to hear that. One that pops up, I thought about this just the other day, is what comes to mind, because I was at a school teaching a fourth grade class about the plants that grew around the edge of their playground. And the principal had invited me there, and the teacher of that class, I could see, was not interested in what I was teaching. I remember her being a very prim woman, and she just was involved with kind of disciplining the children and trying to keep them in line. But they were all being great. They were very interested in what I was telling them. And one of the plants that we went over was one that can be used as a poultice. It's so simple. You simply crush the leaf, and it can literally draw from your body a subcutaneous injection of, say, a bee sting or a fire ant or whatever. And it works beautifully, and it's got anti-inflammatory properties so that it works in a double kind of whammy on you right there very quickly. And as we were nearing the end of our time, that teacher stepped into a fire ant hill.
Oh, no.
And she was stung, and she yelped, and the children just went into shock. They'd never heard her make any sound like that. And the woman started herding the students together quickly and said, "Let's go back inside. I've got to go see about this." And this one little boy, he said, "Well, what about the plant he just showed us for that?" And she said, "What plant?" She hadn't heard about it. And so I just let the little boy take over.
Wow.
And he took her back there. We all went with him. He took a leaf from the plant. He mangled it up and applied it to her sting. She only had a couple of stings. And the sting went away.
Wow.
You know, the sting is there, not from the puncture, but from the acid that's injected by the ant, and it burns.
Right.
And that plant's leaf drew that acid out, and the woman was in disbelief.
Wow.
And she said, "Now, what was the name of this again?"
Can we start this whole thing over again?
Yeah.
Wow. That's, man, that's incredible. So for someone who spends as much time outdoors and exploring and has done that for so long, this may be an unfair question. Do you have any favorite places to go, maybe more specifically than just outdoors, that you love to go explore, visit frequently, just your favorite places in the area?
Yes.
And why I'm not telling you.
Well, I'll name this one. Tallulah Gorge was one of my parents. It helped to raise me. That's where I hitchhiked to. And
wow.
I climbed down into there, and those were my first camping experiences. And it was like being on another planet down there.
Yeah.
When you're by yourself and you're that young. And I always worried about Tallulah Gorge. I worried that it would be developed in some way. And I knew that it could be protected by either being a state park or a wilderness area or whatever. And now that it's a state park, I'm so glad it's preserved, but it's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
All those crowds there, I hate saying that, but I'm glad it's preserved. I'm glad people can see it. But it's not the place that I used to go. So I don't want to name those places, unfortunately.
Fair enough. The next 5-10 years... what would you like to see expand, change, grow, shift in whatever capacity with what you're currently doing and have been doing?
Well, I'm 72 now, so in the next 10 years, who knows? I hope to always be teaching as I'm doing now, and if I can't do certain things, so be it. I'll just have to be a talker and not a doer. And, you know, that's already sneaking up on me in a lot of ways. And I'm okay with that. But so much of my energy now goes into writing. I do that right here at this table where we're sitting. And I write every day. I've got quite a few books out and on the way out. And that's become my late life passion. I've been doing it all my life, ever since I was a little boy. I even made books that I bound as a little boy, self-made books. But now that I'm able to get those out to a wider audience, that's really fulfilling, especially the ones that have to do with nature, because my secret mission, which is now going to be revealed in life, is to try to help bridge that gap that's widening between people and nature.
Yeah,
we have children now born into this world who don't step onto the earth in a day's time. They're on a carpet or wood or whatever, or inside of a car. And I've just got to help see that change. That's been what I've been working on all my life, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Your comment about writing makes me think of something I heard somebody say, I think it was last year or year before. They talked about how the value of reading is so just missed in our culture today. And he said this, and I'll never forget it, because I've enjoyed reading. You know, I don't read as much right now as I used to, but he said, you know, the books you read, he said, that is, sometimes it is the collective gleaning or the wisdom or experience of an entire life that you're reading in 200 pages.
Yeah.
Like, what else can you do that you can get that sort of, and sometimes it's not an entire life, but it may be 5 or 10 years of someone's expertise or their life wisdom or their life passion, that you can take that in a, you know, Cliff Notes version that is very specific and portable and digest that in a day sometimes. You know, it's just, it was, I had never thought about it like that. And certainly the things that you're writing about, whether somebody is, you know, in a rural environment, you know, they lived in, you know, downtown, I think there is something in all of us that you know, we reconnect with life when we start thinking about these things, because we inherently all know that everything we have comes from the resources that we don't daily see, most of us. And I'd never really thought about the value of reading and what I'm digesting and ingesting and internalizing in that fashion before. So I need to probe my home and see if I can bring if I could bring a team up here for a class, because this kind of stuff just fascinates me. I love it. I feel like there's such a huge gap, like you said, of we have all this around us, but nobody knows what to do with it, you know. And you're kind of in that space of saying, I can teach you, you know, I can help, pick me.
Well, what you were talking about there, taking in so much information from one book in a short time, it's the old adage of standing on the shoulders of those who came before us, you know. But there's a paradox about it that is interesting. During that time that I was working for the Georgia Conservancy, I was doing a lot of reading about ecology in different areas. You know, I'd read a book on birds on one day, then another time I'd be reading about rivers and then mammals or whatever. But there's a trap you can get into. You can fall in love with all that reading, just like a person today falls in love with their cell phone and the things that you can get on that. And that, in a way, is one of those things that can grab you, that vicarious learning.
Yeah.
Here's an example. I remember very vividly one afternoon I was reading about beaver. That's an animal that really interests me. And I was learning such great stuff. And after sitting for about 2 hours reading about beaver, I realized how much time I spend reading about these animals, and these people who are writing these books are having the real life experiences. Now, yeah, lucky me, I'm getting to see their compressed life, you know, in these pages, but I'm not doing anything. So I remember slamming that book shut and making a vow to myself that I'm going to go out and I'm going to find something myself today
of
importance. So, well, I did that night about beaver, but let me tell you about that afternoon. I walked out into a wooded area behind the cottage I was renting. And I just was, my eyes were keen to find something that I could say, I learned this today. Mm-hmm. And I came up to a little tiny stream, and right at the edge of it was a box turtle. And his head was down in the water completely. You know, legs splayed and head just stretched out underwater. I didn't see any bubbles, nothing. And I thought, okay, if nothing else today, I will see how long a box turtle can hold its breath. So I stalked up close to it, settled down quietly, and just waited and waited and waited. The turtle was dead. I don't know its story at all, but I thought that was such a funny slap in the face to me.
Oh,
but so here's part two of that story, which is better. That night, I went out into the marsh on the Chattahoochee River in a canoe and just settled in to be among beaver at night and see what I could learn about them. And what I did learn that night was plenty of beaver came out, and when they saw this foreign object floating in the water, I was down low in the canoe with just my head sticking up, they would slap their tails. And if I didn't move, they kept slapping their tails. If I moved, they stopped and they dove under. And what I learned later, and what I began to understand that night, was that when I move, I create a visual for them. They have poor eyesight to begin with. And only when I move can they be certain of what my silhouette is. And then they know what I am. And humans are known quantities to animals. We're the public enemy number one,
right, usually.
And so they dove. But if you go out on a night like that and never move as they slap their tails, you got to be prepared for that, because it's quite a show.
Yeah.
But if you don't move, you're going to see them remain in that state of just trying to surprise you. It's like somebody coming up clapping their hands right in front of your nose, you know, to make you flinch. That's exactly what they want.
Wow.
And, you know, it was simplified in earlier studies saying this is how beaver make warnings to each other. And there's truth to that, no doubt. But mainly it's to make the thing that's present move so that the silhouette becomes more defined.
Yeah.
I will tell you, there's a great new book about beaver out.
Okay.
It's called Eager. That's it. That's the title, Eager. And it's new information about beaver and their incredible importance in stabilizing our land. And it teaches us that the history of America, the landscape, was very different than we imagine it. Because when beaver reigned over the land, we had a very wet landscape in many places here. Would have made it hard for people to get into and out of. And then beaver became the enemy. You know, when I was kind of floating around, living in different places up here in the mountains, for a time I lived up in an attic in a house of an elderly couple up in Sutches. And they lived on this larger farm that they rented the house from. And there was a large beaver dam on Sutches Creek right there. And I got wind of the fact that the local farmers were going to dynamite that dam and the dens. Here in Georgia, you usually don't find the classic beaver lodge. The beaver of the South tend to, or at least let's say North Georgia, tend to prefer to tunnel into the banks. And their plan was to dynamite the banks too, to kill the beaver.
Oh, wow.
So I went around to every farmer and asked for a reprieve for a few days if I could dismantle the dam myself, and which I did, and it took me 2 days to do it.
Wow.
And boy, did I get a respect for the engineers who built that dam. It's incredibly tightly put together. It's hard to believe. But when I'll never forget my first tug on a stick, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be a job. But I couldn't help but all think that all the beaver were watching.
Yes, I'm appreciative. Certain they
were. Not appreciative at the moment, but only if they knew.
You've got how many books currently out?
Well, I've got out four books called Secrets of the Forest, four volumes. That's all about my teachings in nature. And it's geared toward three kinds of people. Number one is the person who wants to learn in detail how to master these skills, including plant work, fire making, weapons like archery, spear, addle, blowgun, tracking, stalking. All these books cover these things in depth for that kind of student. The second is the person who maybe is employed as a guide or a park ranger or a scout leader or whatever, where you have the charge of some wards that you are trying to teach about nature, and you really don't know quite how to go about it. So in these books, I have hundreds of original activities that I've used, and they're kind of written up like scripts to help them know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The third person is the parent and the grandparent who wants to know, how do I get my child interested in nature? And that's where all of our hope lies, right there. Mm-hmm. If we can just get a new generation to fall in love with nature again. Okay, so I was on my way to the books. There are those four books.
Yep.
I have three books out on Wyatt Earp, the Western lawman. That's been a lifelong study of mine. And those are historical fiction, all based upon the newest facts from all the researchers who are good friends of mine. And I have a book, a memoir on my 2 years that I lived in a teepee. That's called Two Winters in a Teepee. And I've got a book coming out, a novel, which is a Western, coming out next year. And a couple more books that are novels. I'm a novelist at heart. I love the creative process of that.
Awesome.
So that's
awesome.
All the books.
Okay. So before we get to how people find out about you, where you're going to be soon, I like to ask what I call the lightning round question, which is in every episode is a question that has nothing to do about anything that we talk about generally. However, one of the questions I thought about was, given your background and expertise in survivalist and living off the land and that sort of thing, if you were shipwrecked on a desert island and you could only bring three things with you, one cannot be a radio to call home. what would those three things be based on your expertise and how you would use those three things to survive?
Well, anybody who teaches or is involved in survival skills, as we call it, quickly learns the value of a sharp blade.
Mm-hmm.
So a knife is the most basic tool that you would ever want in a situation like that. You know, it's tempting to say something like a firearm, to think about your immediate need for meat, for example, how mm-hmm. much easier that would be than, say, a spear or a bow. But the problem there is, if you don't get in that wish, unlimited ammunition, you know, where are you then? You've got a pretty fancy club to use.
Yes,
on an animal.
Exactly.
And that's one of the beauties of the primitive skills, is that all of these things are renewable.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about a bow and arrow, there's no part of archery that you can't replace mm-hmm. by using materials from the out of doors. So I'm just going to stick with the knife, and I would like to start off with some nice clothes that I'm wearing, so I don't have to. If I went naked into the wilderness, which of course is the great ultimate, that's a hard job. That is
sure.
So hard to create your clothing and to go about the hunting process, which you'd have to do. And,
yeah.
Mm, so I'll just end that with the knife.
Okay.
And how about pencil and paper?
I'd
want to keep writing.
So I can write about it. So how do people find out about you, your classes, somebody that just lives in a, normal subdivision in, wherever, Lawrenceville or Athens or wherever, and they'd love to get some of their neighbors and come up for a day to do a class together. Great bonding experience. A great time to, get out from their normal surroundings. How do they go about scheduling something like that? And you've got a few events that you're already have on the calendar coming up. What are those? Where are they at? And how do people find you?
Well, first, there's my website, medicinebow.net. And there you can find the class schedule for public classes, and you'll find also descriptions of the skills that I teach and how those classes go, and contact information. So either by phone or by email. My email address is medicinebow@att.net. That's how I get most of my inroads into other folks' lives. And you know, when you mention everyday people out in their everyday lives venturing into something kind of esoteric like this, I don't expect people to be rabid survivalists to be interested in something like this. You can enrich your life. You can keep the life you've got and improve it by just adding a few things to it so that you are more integrated with nature around you. Maybe it's just adding a few things to your meal that are wild edibles that grow around your area. And you'll be surprised at how that changes your perspective about your land because you're eating from it. But a person who hikes the Appalachian Trail, for example, and carries all that gear on their back, if they will just incorporate one little skill into that hiking trip, that next hiking trip, they'll find that their trip was enhanced because they felt more like a participant of the area rather than a visitor. You ask about things coming up. I've got a program coming up on the 26th of July at Brasstown Ball, and that will be the program Through the Eyes of the Cherokee.
Okay.
Where we will just roam through some natural area and learn about a wealth of species of plants or items, you know, that could be something else like stone or who knows what. And that will be at 1 o'clock at Brasstown Ball. And then again there on August 15th, another one I'll be doing on Cherokee medicines will be at Hamilton Gardens near Hiawassee. And that's on August 21st. That's at 11 a.m. And that's at the Towns County Civic Center.
And are those things that people need to RSVP for or just show up?
I think there's a sign up for those. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Your calendared events as they get added to your schedule as we move on through this year and the years coming, are those generally posted in a certain place, area? Do you have a...
Yeah, the public schedule is always on the website.
Okay.
So you can just click on schedule and get to that. And I put out a new calendar every two seasons. So right now there's a spring-summer calendar that's published on the website.
Okay.
And a new fall-winter calendar will come out in September that will cover those two seasons. And those I email to folks who happen to be on my email mail list.
Okay.
So if you'd like to be on that list, just send me an email, and I'll be glad to put you on there. So then you'll receive that personally. Otherwise, the website's there.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, this has been everything I was hoping for, and then some. I'm excited at the opportunity to hopefully recruit some folks to come up with me to do a class, because I love all this stuff we've talked about is right up my alley. And yeah, thank you. Just you know, as part of our North Georgia population, thank you for having gone through the struggling and you know, the non-traditional path of getting to where you're at now to be able to educate and help others, especially with your passion for the younger generation and helping them reconnect with our natural surroundings. That's something we definitely need some more of. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. Mark, I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you for coming out here, Jake, to do this. I really appreciate it.
This is the North Georgia Life Podcast. Embrace life where you live.